No crops are allowed to enter other markets. We demand an urgent opening of the borders so our crops can reach the West Bank in the same day they are exported, so the produce get there fresh.
This rally is held to protest the persistent Israeli restrictions on exports of Palestinian crops from Gaza to the West Bank. The impossible conditions that the Israeli regime imposed are aimed at damaging Palestinian crops and preventing the farmers from having a better income. This is a systematic policy to collapse the Palestinian economy and isolate it from the world. Farmers here call on the international community to stop these restrictions. The estimated daily loss for Palestinian farmers is very high.
The Israeli regime keeps imposing restrictions on Palestinian traders and farmers, keeping them from exporting their crops. Palestinian traders and farmers called on the international community to stop these restrictions that led to serious financial losses and dealt a blow to the Palestinian economy. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
See a ring of steel and a little army of police, think the British Conservative Party. Here in Manchester for their annual conference, with the party leader pitching his Building Back Better mantra yet again. Crashing the party, thousands of protesters from far and wide to tell the Prime Minister he and his clique are not welcome.
There's an array of groups and people who have gathered here today to demonstrate against the Conservative government pretty much everything it stands for, from its domestic policy to foreign policy, from its pandemic response and its position on migrants to its participation in foreign wars and its support for foreign occupation.
And they say examples of the government's failures aren't too difficult to find.
There's a gigantic economic catastrophe threatening the lives of ordinary people. There's a gigantic climate catastrophe threatening the whole planet. There is every reason why we can't trust a government of the rich, for the rich, to deal with these problems.
Another reason that's brought these demonstrators here, the controversial policing bill that gives UK police sweeping powers.
They don't need more powers. They need to be engaging with people in a protective way, not in a way where it's oppressive.
As a result of what critics call conservative government inaction, the UK has experienced one of the highest COVID death tolls in the world, massive economic downturn, a humiliating retreat from Afghanistan, hiking taxes, fuel disruptions, and a rise in Islamophobia and xenophobia in recent years.
I want to make it really clear to the Tories that they're not welcome in this city, that actually their position on fueling racism, targeting refugees, is absolutely disgusting, and therefore we want to make sure that they know just how angry we are.
A decade of conservative rule in the UK has led to a groundswell of public dissatisfaction, which experts say will manifest itself in the 2024 general election. Saeed Puriza, Manchester.
Tears were shed and prayers held in London's Marble Arch, bringing the sights and sounds of Karbala to thousands that gathered there from all over the UK. People from different backgrounds, but all with one thing in common: their love for the Prophet's grandson, who was martyred on the sands of Karbala in the year 680.
This is an extension of the world's largest peaceful procession. And despite the COVID-19 pandemic, millions of people have taken part this year to commemorate Imam Hussein and his family's sacrifice and evoke their message.
Imam Hussein and his family symbolize so many things for those that hold him in their hearts, hope for the oppressed being one of them.
This is the message of Karbala. He did it so that oppression and oppressors could be brought to light. And, people who are innocent, they have hope. So it's a message of hope as well, that you're not alone in this world. There are great personalities, there are people in the world who are ready to fight for you, to die for you.
What Imam Hussein's family went through after his martyrdom is also a focal point of Arba'een, and the role the women played in the struggle.
We don't need to kind of look to secular role models, or, to kind of take on wholesale this kind of Marxist feminism. We already have women within the family of the Holy Prophet, who had great strength and great dignity. And the important thing is knowledge. This is what we should be as women. We should be people of knowledge. That's the priority.
Every year, this procession highlights events that took place centuries ago, reminding humanity of the ongoing battle against tyranny that we all face today. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The Iranian radar system, dubbed Shams, can create simulated electronic warfare scenarios to train fresh military personnel. The system was unveiled together with other defense equipment, all built by the Iranian Army's Air Defense Force.
The fully indigenous Shams system is a long-range radar simulator and allows us to design and execute a range of war scenarios. This way we can enhance the preparedness of our staff members against potential missile attacks and other aerial threats.
Hormuz was another radar system that was put into service on Saturday. It's a medium-range tactical radar capable of detecting and tracking air targets at high, medium, and low altitudes. Iran's Air Defense Force says the new equipment will significantly increase the country's air defense capability.
The major feature of Hormuz radar system is that it can calculate the speed of the target while accurately calculating the distance and sending the data to the fire control systems. I should say that all of the equipment unveiled today and earlier were designed and produced using domestic know-how. We no longer need to import any such equipment from other countries.
Iran has for four decades been under U.S.-led arms embargoes, which prevent the country from purchasing any foreign-made arms. This has over the years prompted the Islamic Republic to try to develop its own weapons to ensure its security. Every year, the country unveils a range of domestically built defense equipment, from UAVs to missiles, as a show of its military might against the backdrop of U.S. sanctions.
The Islamic Republic views U.S. sanctions as a tailwind that has pushed the country toward self-reliance. While these latest military equipment can be counted as a case in point, Army officials say this is just the tip of the iceberg, as Iran has indigenized over 80% of its defense arsenal. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Pakistan has lost tens of thousands of its citizens and security personnel since late 2001 when Islamabad joined so-called U.S. war on terror. Pakistan provided the U.S. with its military bases to carry out attacks on Afghanistan and allow the NATO supply line to pass through Pakistan to the neighboring country. But it all backfired with the retaliatory attacks and massive public resentment against the U.S. and successive governments for supporting American imperialistic agenda across the region. After recent humiliating exit of U.S. from Afghanistan and the return of Taliban government in Kabul, Islamabad has changed its pro-U.S. policy. Now Pakistan has decided to bring an end to two decades-long violence through negotiation with the different groups working under the umbrella of Pakistani brand of Taliban movement and other groups engaged in insurgency in southwestern Balochistan province.
In fact, I think some of the Pakistani Taliban groups actually want to talk to the to our government, for some peace, for some reconciliation. And we are in talks with some of the groups. I do not believe in military solutions. I'm anti-military solutions. So I always believe that, you know, as a politician, political dialogue is the way ahead.
Before the change of guards in Kabul, Pakistan blamed India to have been using different militant groups from Afghan soil to fan insurgency in its southwestern and northwestern regions bordering with Afghanistan.
The Ashraf Ghani government and other hostile governments in Kabul were providing them conducive conditions to attack Pakistan. But now that the Talibans are there and Talibans have guaranteed or have assured Pakistan that this, the Afghan land will not be used will not be allowed to be used against Pakistan.
Many militant groups have repeatedly attacked in Pakistan on Beijing's economic and geostrategic interests linked with its global project known as Belt and Road Initiative. The mega project starts from Chinese province Xinjiang and passes through nearly 3,000-kilometer-long road network of Pakistan before sailing through Arabian Sea to reach onwards rest of Asia, Africa, and parts of Europe. Both Washington and New Delhi have publicly opposed the China's mega project, which has challenged the economic hegemony of the U.S. Now Islamabad wants to win over the terrorist groups through a reconciliation process in an effort to wean them away from the foreign powers, using them to disrupt over $50 billion investment of China in Pakistan. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
On Friday in the Italian capital, over 3,000 Alitalia workers staged a new protest against the government's decision to shut down Italy's flag carrier since 1947. Alitalia is to be replaced by a slimmed-down state-owned airline called ITA, Italia Trasporto Aereo, that is planned to take over many of its assets. For years, Alitalia workers have held protests trying to block the morphing operation, which base unions say will result in the loss of thousands of jobs.
8,000 jobs will be slashed under the deal. Furthermore, we estimate that three external workers for each sacked Alitalia employee will find themselves unemployed. This is social butchery. Our country should be ashamed. The plan is to take a competitor like Alitalia out to make things easier for Air France, British Airways and Lufthansa.
In practical terms, the government is wiping the national collective agreement off. Workers in the aviation industry will no longer have any protection. They will become on-call employees. It's a shame that our largest left-leaning party and the largest unions have opted to team up with neoliberal forces.
Last month, the EU competition regulators surprisingly approved the morphing of debt-stricken Alitalia into a smaller company, conceding that the new state-owned airline was not liable for repaying €900 million in illegal state aid received by its forerunner.
The demand is that we need Alitalia. Italy needs a flag company. That's why we are here. And ITA is not that.
The new ITA airline will operate with less than half of Alitalia's fleet of aircraft. Pilot and aircrew pay is set to be almost halved. ITA is reportedly set to introduce a new labor contract aimed at giving it greater flexibility and competitiveness.
The 74-year-old Italian flag carrier Alitalia is set to fly for the last time on October 15. On the same day, its new incarnation airline, ITA, will start operating with 2,800 employees. More than two-thirds of Alitalia's staff, however, will be laid off. Max Civili, Rome.
Iran's Army Ground Forces on Friday launched a military exercise in the northwestern region close to the borders with Azerbaijan and Armenia. Artillery, drone, and electronic warfare units with aerial support from the Army's Airborne Division are participating in the exercise. The drill is codenamed Conquerors of Khaybar, a reference to the 7th century Battle of Khaybar, in which Prophet Muhammad and his army of early Muslims foiled a plot hatched by Jewish tribes. Iran's Army Ground Forces commander, Brigadier General Qomars Haydari, who is leading the drills, says his country will not tolerate the presence of Israeli elements or terrorists in the region.
We respect the sovereignty of all countries, including our neighbors, but are strongly against the presence of the Zionist regime as well as the Daesh terrorists.
Iran has long voiced concern over what it calls the presence of Israeli elements and terrorists near its northwestern borders. Tehran says the terrorists assembled there at the invitation of a regional state at the height of a 2020 conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan. Iran particularly accuses Israel of hatching plots in order to sow discord among Muslim nations, saying the regime sees its survival through creating insecurity. Some analysts say the drills send a clear and powerful message to other countries against any acts that challenge Iran's sovereignty and territorial integrity.
This one here in the Northwest is very significant because it's sending out a clear message that Iran is not going to be passive. They're going to proactively be hunting and seeking out any forces which are trying to violate the stability of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And don't forget, it's been done because the Azerbaijani themselves have talked about a southern Azerbaijan, referring to the Iranian territories, which are the province of Azerbaijan, as essentially theirs. Now, this is something the Israelis, I'm sure, can stoke up really quite a lot in terms of trying to create division and fragmentation.
Moreover, General Haidari also made it clear that the Islamic Republic will not tolerate any change to the official borders. He stressed that the transit routes in the region should remain safe and secure, and that all the regional countries should respect the flow of trade and energy through their borders. Last week, Iran's Islamic Revolution's Guard Corps held a separate military exercise in the northwestern province of Ardabil. The drill drew criticism from Azerbaijan's President Ilham Aliyev, who said he was surprised by Iran's decision since it hadn't held maneuvers in the region for about three decades. Iran's foreign ministry, however, reacted to Aliyev's remarks, saying the drills was meant to secure regional peace and security.
Afghanistan's Deputy Minister of Information and Culture, Zabihullah Mujahid, says the United States has violated the country's airspace by its drones. He accused Washington of violating all international law, as well as a U.S.-Taliban peace deal signed between the two sides. He said the violations must be controlled and prevented.
Daesh presence in Afghanistan is not a big headache for us. Our forces are capable to uproot them here without receiving any foreign support. So the U.S. must honor the Doha deal and stop violating our space.
Mujahid's statement followed remarks by Pentagon spokesman John Kirby. He said the U.S. retained all necessary authorities to execute over-the-horizon counter-terrorism operations. Kirby also said Washington remains confident in its capabilities moving forward without speaking to specific rules of engagement surrounding airstrikes. He said there is currently no requirement to clear airspace with the Taliban. Analysts say since the U.S. did not fulfill its commitments to Afghanistan over the past 20 years, it is not expected to honor other pacts like U.S.-Taliban Doha deal.
Violating Afghanistan's sovereignty is not a new move by the U.S. It has repeatedly broken its promises, mainly when it comes to respecting our country's sovereignty, even during the rule of former governments here.
Given the U.S. is insisting on continuation of drone strikes in Afghanistan without coordination with the Taliban, the group has also warned the U.S. of negative consequences of continuing violation of Afghanistan's airspace. The U.S. claims that it targets terrorist groups like Daesh with its airstrikes. However, evidence on the ground shows that innocent Afghans are usually the real victims of such attacks. One of the last U.S. drone strikes was in Kabul on August 29 and killed 10 members of a family, including six children. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Spotlight.
Welcome to the Spotlight. A new study shows U.S. police killings are undercounted by more than half over the past four decades, resulting in the death figure being cut off by over 17,000. The study conducted at the University of Washington raises questions about racial bias among medical examiners and highlights the lack of reliable national record keeping. It compared death certificates with data from organizations that tracked U.S. police killings between 1980 and 2018. Findings also pointed to disproportionate killings of African Americans who were fatally shot at a rate of 3.5 times more than their white counterparts. Co-lead author of the study says they realized a vast discrepancy while reviewing police violence data after the 2020 murder of George Floyd. According to the paper, the undercounted killings are not necessarily missing, but are miscategorized. For more on that, we're joined by our correspondent, Colin Campbell, who's with us from Washington. Colin, what do these numbers mean?
Well, these numbers mean that they are not really dedicated to understanding just how deleterious police involvements are when it comes to shootings and its impact on the black community and communities of color, as we see that there are disproportionate ways that communities of color are affected by police shootings. Now, of course, this is not a new conversation. This is something that has been discussed for decades, but still we haven't seen that will coming from politicians or from the police to really track these shootings more accurately. What does that do? Well, that sets in place white hegemony, that power struggle that whites have struggled and wanted to maintain throughout decades since the founding of this country. And they do it using the police force. And then we see that it goes to another level on the stretch or the lengths of fatalities that black people and communities of color suffer at the hands of police. And so what there needs to be is reform to how these records are being collected, the reports that are being made, and the repercussions that happen when there is a police shooting and someone dies, and it's very unclear whether or not that shooting was necessary. The high-profile cases, we do hear about those, like George Floyd, not a shooting, but still a police killing. But there are so many other shootings that happen across the country that go unreported, that don't get the media spectacle that other cases do. And these still leave behind shattered lives, families, friends, brothers, sisters, you name it. These people are all victims of police shootings, and then their families are also victimized as well. So this really has to be taken a lot more seriously, something that hasn't been done in the history of the U.S., and it's just now being revealed. I would suppose that there are going to be advocacy groups that will really try to campaign to the president to take a stand on this, whether or not it's something that he has his Justice Department adjust, at least federally, and then hopefully it trickles down to states and then local municipalities. But something needs to be done as of yesterday, in fact.
All right, thanks a lot. Colin Campbell joining us from Washington, D.C. Our guests joining us on tonight's Spotlight are former Chief Deputy U.S. Marshal Matthew Fogg, joining us from Washington, D.C., and Professor of African American Studies at the University of Houston, Gerald Horn, who's with us from Houston, Texas. Well, let's start off with Mr. Horn in Houston. Welcome to the program here on Press TV Spotlight. This report found that between 1980 and 2018, more than 55% of deaths from police violence, that's over 17,000 in total, were either misclassified or went unreported. Plain and simple, is this a cover-up?
It is a cover-up. It's a tragedy. It's also a crime against humanity. As you may know, the Black community through our organizations have been clamoring for a United Nations human rights investigation of this quasi-genocidal pattern that has been inflicted upon the Black community. And I urge and encourage the international community to move with all due deliberate speed to intervene, because what's going on cannot be allowed to continue. You should also know that in today's newspapers, there was another stunning article about the fact that as of 2020 alone, there were 70,000 cases of missing Black girls, girls under the age of 18. Where have they gone? Where have they disappeared to? At the same time, Black children only are 14% of the nation's children population, but they're 31% of the children that are missing. What's going on in the United States is obviously an outgrowth of slavery. It's obviously an outgrowth of the unresolved issues that followed slavery, speaking of the hated apartheid system known as Jim Crow. And you should know that that system only began to retreat because of international pressure. And I dare say that today's tragedies will likewise only retreat under unremitting international pressure.
Matthew Fogg in Washington, D.C., do you agree with Mr. Horn? This is an effort to conceal the truth. Even so, the figures are still too high anyways, aren't they?
Oh, the figures are staggering. I mean, when you look at the numbers of the percentage of African Americans that live in the United States, and you're talking about the numbers, the disproportionate numbers of those that are missing or having some type of a negative impact in their life, it's crazy. I mean, yes, I agree 100%. Until this country recognizes that it has a racial issue that is perpetuated from slavery and all the way back, and that the country is still very much divided on this issue, we're going to have problems. It's definitely in law enforcement, that's for sure.
Let's go back to Mr. Horn. The study, it discovers that Black Americans are 3.5 times more likely to be killed by police than white Americans, and Hispanic people are killed at a ratio of 1.8 times higher than non-Hispanic white people. The review of data shows that many fatal police encounters are misclassified, but often, most often when the victim is Black or Hispanic. Again, the minorities here bear the brunt of all this. Tell us more, please.
Well, it's interesting. The study that you mentioned references killings by the police. But keep in mind, there are other cases that even this study, as significant and profound as it is, did not encompass. Recall that just a few years ago, not far from where I'm sitting in Houston, Texas, there was the case of the young black woman, Sandra Bland, who was pulled over by the police because of a traffic violation, was taken to jail, and apparently was so harassed and so traumatized by being in prison that she hung herself. So that would be classified as a suicide, although it's fair to say that the proximate cause of her death was her maltreatment and mistreatment by the police. You should also note that just recently in the U.S. Congress in Washington, D.C., there was an attempt to pass a change in the law, the so-called George Floyd Policing Act. You referenced George Floyd, the black man in May 2020 in Minnesota, who was killed on camera at the hands, or I should say at the knee, on the neck, administered by a Minnesota police officer. But what's striking is that the Republican Party, the opposition party, did not negotiate in good faith. They basically claimed in a demagogic fashion that if the federal government wants to hold back funds to police departments that use chokeholds, which is an illegal way to restrain a potential suspect, which oftentimes leads to that suspect's death, or if the police department continues to use no-knock warrants, that's when the police don't knock on the door. They just come through your door without knocking and start shooting anybody who resists. The Republicans claim that if you try to restrain and cut off funds from police departments who use such crazy tactics, that that's something that will not go down well with them. And so the bill died. And so presumably, police departments are still authorized in many cities to use chokeholds, to use no-knock warrants, and this will continue to cause an escalation and rise of the deaths of citizens, particularly black American citizens.
Matthew Fogg, past studies have analyzed underreporting of fatal police incidents and how black Americans disproportionately die from police violence, but those previous researches, they were conducted over much shorter time periods. This report, it covered 40 years. Do you believe that the manner of conduct has been the same basically for decades?
Well, I've been in law enforcement for 30 years. I've also been a police expert on law enforcement race issues for about 20 years. I've won a major case against the U.S. Department of Justice myself, fighting racism internally behind the blue wall of silence. I've been there. I've seen how officers can conduct themselves in ways that certainly it's not part of our training, but it becomes a culture once you get on the job. And the problem is within law enforcement, and yes, the report is 100% hitting on. I mean, this goes way back. Like I said, for all of the years that I've been in the U.S. Marshals and was a member in law enforcement, worked with dragnet operations all over the country, I had a chance to actually see it in place. And I'm with an organization like right behind me called Blacks in Government, and I'm also was the front page of a news article on my other side that says Bigots with Badges, which is my book that's coming out. But the bottom line is this. Racism is infiltrated. The FBI came out and did a report and indicated how many of these subversive, these very, we'll call right-wing racist groups have infiltrated law enforcement. So it is a problem in America. It goes all the way back to the Hoover administration, back when Hoover over the FBI. I mean, we know that law enforcement has been a tool that has been used to actually, as Chief Justice Warren said, who's now deceased, he said the police officer is more powerful than the President of the United States because they have a right to forfeit a person's freedom, their property, or their life at any given time according on what they perceive their discretion. So this is a problem, and it's a problem that we have to address in America. I've tried to do it with my job. I didn't become one of those police officers that waited until I retired. But I took on the system right when I was there and actually saw these things that we're talking about now, the chokeholds and what happened with George Floyd. And we go even New York City Police Department when the mayor de Blasio spoke out about telling his black sons to be careful, and the whole half the police department turned their backs on him. So it is a problem in America, and I think right now with the whole issue of Black Lives Matter, these reports that are coming out, it's saying that this is just not conjured up stuff, but this is real, and we're going to have to figure out a way to deal with it, whether it's in Congress or whether it's marching, but it's got to be dealt with.
Mr. Horn, the study brings forth a grim reality here. Despite years of scrutiny, criticism, protests, calls for reform, no government agency tracks how often law enforcement officers in America kill people. Now, if that's the case, how can anyone ever follow up on these findings or pursue a path that leads somewhere in terms of making a change?
Well, that's a very good question. However, your audience should know that The Guardian, the London-based newspaper, interestingly enough, has been trying to keep statistics and figures on how many people are killed by the police in the United States of America, because obviously there are authorities in the United States of America that are not interested in collecting such data, because I assume they feel that it would be indicting them. Also, the Washington Post in the United States of America has tried as well to keep such figures. But to follow up on what your guest said, studies have shown that in Los Angeles, the second largest metropolis in the United States of America, in the sheriff's department, you have right-wing gangs that prey upon black men in particular, and even have certain kinds of games that they play to show that they have basically harassed or otherwise intimidated or worse, injured or maimed black men in particular. Obviously, this is a cofactor on the skyrocketing incarceration rates of black men in particular, although the rates for black women also are escalating sharply. The United States probably imprisons a higher percentage of its population than any other nation on planet Earth. And then there's the death penalty. Black people are more likely to be subjected to the death penalty, subjected to execution by the state, and they're more likely to be executed if they kill a white person than if they kill a person who is not defined as white. Now, obviously, this is outrageous. It should not be allowed to stand. But once again, I think that we'll need pressure from the international community in order for this system of inequality, this staggering crime against humanity, to somehow cease.
Matthew Fogg, let's talk about it. Mr. Horn just mentioned the issue of the judicial system. Let's talk about the much-seen police impunity in black deaths. As seen time and time again, the judicial system is mostly in favor of the police, especially if the victims, especially if the police are white, the victims are of a community of color. Why is this common practice in U.S. courts?
Well, it just shows how systemic racism is. I mean, it just shows you that across the board. I mean, again, I challenge the U.S. Department of Justice, most powerful law enforcement, probably organization in the world, because we as U.S. Marshals work under them. I challenged it for race discrimination. In 1998, I got a landmark verdict that said racism was systemic within the U.S. Marshals. And today, I'm the class agent representing over 1,500 black U.S. Marshals, the same type of thing that is going on today. So what we have, we say, if it's happening internally, if I got to deal with a bigot with a badge working next to me, imagine what they're going to do to the public. So reality of it is that, yes, the court systems, everybody's in on it. And the reality of it is that until it becomes an issue in America where we start to address it, start to talk about it, it somewhat came out once this past administration and we started having Black Lives Matter and people started marching in the street. Then all of a sudden, that's where the George Floyd Protection Act came out. Now, the organization I'm with, Blacks in Government, we actually did a resolution, and we passed that resolution, telling Congress we supported the George Floyd Protection Act. But it's so much more, because what has happened is we're now beginning to see how entrenched America is on these issues. And as these reports come out, people are now asking the question, well, how can this be in America when we're supposed to be a land that says we're the country of the free? We have to address the fact that in law enforcement, like I said, I'm an expert on the inside. I know what we do. And what I'm saying is, and the culture is such that when you speak up, you become a whistleblower. Actually, you become the bad guy. Once you start speaking up and saying, this has got to stop, it's got to end. We did the same thing with the war on drugs. We took the war on drugs and we built one of the largest prison industrial complexes the world has ever seen, but mainly on the backs of African Americans. When I started noticing that, I brought that up to my managers. I said, listen, we're gonna stop going in the urban areas and making arrests. We're going to start going into some of these more affluent areas, these white areas, these areas where the most drugs and the best stuff comes from. He said, Frog, if you go into those locations and you do that, he said, what's going to happen? They're going to have pushback. They're going to contact their congressman, their lawyer, their judge, whoever. He said, and then next thing you know, they're going to shut our operation down. So we have to understand it is internally. There are a lot of police officers, a lot of people recognize it. We see it. You don't have to wait for a report. You can actually see the studies, and you can look around you and see who actually goes to prison for these crimes and who don't, who gets a break or whatever, or privilege, we call it, in America. So it is a problem.
All right, Gerald Horn. Researchers, they identified places where misclassification of the deaths often occurred, noting that medical examiners or coroners who must fill out the cause of death when there's suspicion of foul play, including police violence, they can be embedded in or work for the police departments. Now, if the medical examiner, a coroner, or other certifier fails to indicate police involvement in the cause of death on the death certificate, the incident, it could be misclassified. How concerning are these findings?
Well, it's extremely concerning. And what you just mentioned points to a structural problem, a structural flaw in the criminal justice system. It's not only that the coroners and the medical examiners oftentimes work hand in glove with the police departments. These are their comrades, these are their colleagues, and they're very unlikely to present data that might be indicting of their comrades and colleagues. The same holds true for the prosecuting authorities. That is to say, prosecuting authorities are reluctant to bring criminal cases against police officers who break the law because they too work hand in glove. They too see the police officers as their comrades and colleagues. And then you turn to the law itself. Right now, in many jurisdictions in the United States of America, you have this regulation or law called qualified immunity. What that means is that a police officer, generally speaking, can kill, steal, or rape and not necessarily be found liable if someone wants to sue them for damages. It's also unlikely, I'm afraid to say, for them to be found guilty of a crime because of the structure of the law. Once again, we can't begin to understand this outrage unless you understand the system of slavery, unless you begin to understand that system, which basically equated black people with being akin to horses, mules, and cattle, not part of the human family. And to this very day, there's that lingering idea that black people were not part of the human family. And since there has not been a sufficient interrogation, not to mention excoriation, of that particular canard, that lie, okay, that outrage, the system continues to persist.
And one quick question, get a final thought from Matthew Fogg. We were talking about the issue of medical examiners and coroners. The practices are showing that racism is occurring not just during the encounter itself, but even after the individual has passed away. Does this show how deeply embedded systemic racism is in different aspects of American life, most notably in issues pertaining to health?
Well, if someone said it's walking, breathing, driving while black, and death while black. And yes, I mean, the reality of it is that the country has not relinquished its past, and it continues to hold on to that past and the remnants of the past. And like I said, being in law enforcement, having been on the front lines, and having been wanting to be a part of an organization that would say equal justice. But when you're talking about racism in America, I mean, it's just not there. And we as black law enforcement officers, the other officers who recognize it, we owe an oath and a duty to this country and a service to this country to stand up and report it. But yes, you are correct. The disparities are there 100% in just about everything we do.
Thanks a lot. That's all the time we have. Allow me to thank my guests, former Chief Deputy U.S. Marshal Matthew Fogg, joining us from Washington, D.C. Also thanks to Professor of African American Studies at University of Houston, Mr. Gerald Thorne, joining us from Houston, Texas. Also special thanks to you, our guests, for staying with us on this issue of Spotlight. It's good night for now and bye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
Dear listeners, as a reminder, we talked about Imam Khomeini's recommendations to the seminaries and religious scholars of ulama, which were issued in his faithful message and also in his testament. In today's program, we're going to touch upon Imam's advice to the executive branch of the government, especially the foreign ministry and Iranian diplomats. Stay with us for more. Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, used to stress that if the executive branch of the government is not reformed, no remarkable result would be gained for the nation, even if there were good laws. He wrote in his testament, "Among the affairs that need to be reformed, purified, and cared for is the executive branch of the government. Sometimes progressive and useful laws may be passed in the parliament, and the Guardian Council may approve it, and the relevant minister may proclaim it, but it may go to unrighteous executors so that they would annul it, and contrary to the rules, or with the bureaucracies and twisting that they have got used to, or intentionally, they act in a way to make people worried, to gradually cause a row." Imam Khomeini considered honest bond with people and rendering services to them, especially to the less well-off and deprived classes, as an undeniable necessity of the Islamic Republic. He used to emphasize that neglecting the principle is religiously forbidden and would incur divine wrath. The Imam wrote, "The budget from which you and the employees of the ministries are paid from belongs to the nation. you should be the servants of the nation, especially the oppressed. And you should know that causing trouble for people and acting opposite to their duty is haram or religiously forbidden, and God forbid would sometimes incur divine wrath. All of you need the nation's support. It was with the people's support, particularly the less well-off and the deprived classes, that victory was achieved, and the hand of the oppressive kingdom was cut off from the country and its reserves. And if one day you are deprived of their support, you will be put aside, and, like the oppressive royal regime, oppressors would occupy the posts instead of you. In view of this tangible reality, you must try to draw the people's attention and refrain from un-Islamic and inhumane behavior. Khomeini, may God bless his soul, said in a famous speech to cabinet ministers and the government, he said, "Serve this nation which has cut off the treacherous hands and has put its trust in you. As long as you are such, the nation will back you, and as long as the nation accompanies you, no harm will occur to you and the country." The Imam writes to the foreign ministry and diplomats, "I recommend the foreign minister in this era and the next era to be heedful that your responsibility is very much either in the reformation and development of the ministry and embassies or the foreign ministry, safeguarding the independence of this country and the interests of this country, and good relations with governments which don't intend to meddle in our country's affairs. And seriously refrain from anything that is suspicious of dependence with all of its dimensions. And know that dependence in some affairs, although it may have a deceptive appearance or interest and use for the time being, however, it would draw the country to destruction." Imam Khomeini believed that an important step towards independence of the foreign ministry is to reinforce bonds with Islamic countries, and asked the diplomatic missions to embark on awakening the Islamic countries and inviting Muslim nations to unity and solidarity. The Imam wrote, "I recommend to the nations of Islamic countries not to expect anyone from abroad to help you in reaching the goal which is Islam and executing Islamic laws and rules. You yourselves should rise up for this vital affair which will materialize freedom and independence." And the great religious scholars and respectful preachers of Islamic countries should invite governments to get rid of dependence on big foreign powers and to rely on their own abilities. In this way, they will embrace victory. And they should invite nations to unity and refrain from racism, which is opposite to the rule of Islam. And shake hands of brotherhood with their brethren in faith in any country and with any race, as the great Islam has called on them as brothers. And if one day this brotherhood in faith materializes with the efforts of governments and nations and the help of Almighty God, you will see that Muslims will form the greatest power on earth. Imam Khomeini also warns staff of the foreign ministry by saying, "Since the victory of the Islamic Revolution, I have issued recommendations to foreign ministers about development of embassies, which should be compatible with Islamic Republic. Yet, some of them either didn't want to or failed to take any positive action." Thank you.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.